All right. Welcome to Music on the Rocks with Chris Castellanos. And my guest today is one of my favorite people in the world. He is an awesome person, awesome musician, just one of the greats, Tom Leslie in Las Vegas, Nevada over there. How you doing, Tom?
It's a hot day here, man, but I'm hanging in there. I've got my martini, so I'm set.
Yes. Well, I am having a single malt. This is a Texas single malt. You know this one?
Texas single malt? No, I don't know that one.
Falcone's?
You must like it. That bottle is almost all gone.
I know. Well, I've had it for a while. My friends in the Four Hornsmen of the Apocalypse came over once when they were in Utah, and they brought this bottle to me, and I made barbecue for them. So it was an even trade.
Oh, man. Fancy. You're making barbecue.
Not messing around, man.
They say that musicians make some of the best cooks, especially when they're drinking. So what does that mean? Does that mean that we make better music if we were drinking? I think not.
Yeah, I know that that does not work.
I could never do that either.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. So what kind of martini are you drinking?
You know, my martini lessons I originally got from my mentors, Jay Julian from Tennessee and Colonel John Bourgeois from the Marine Band. And when they took me under their wing back in the mid-90s, they invited my wife and I to go to lunch with them one day at ABA. And we went thinking, what a great honor. And it was a great honor, not realizing that it was a three martini lunch. So at that rate, we learned how to drink Beefeater martinis, up dry with a twist. I think that probably Dr. Julian would freak out right now if he saw ice in my martini glass.
Well, I know you told me a little earlier that the only reason the ice is in there is because the title of the podcast, Music on the Rocks. So thank you and cheers, Tom.
You, my friend.
Well, right on. I have a bunch of questions for you here. First of all, I just wanted to kind of go over how you got into music. You grew up in Iowa, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town in Iowa. The name of the town was Muscatine, a little town of about 20,000 people right on the Mississippi River. In fact, for a while, I lived in a house that was right on the river. And it was a very proud little band town. In the early part of the 20th century, they had hosted the Sousa Band several times to the Opera House. And it was, in many ways, similar to Harold Hill and the Music Man, where somebody comes to town, they build a band, and all the kids want to be in it. Everybody's excited, and the parents are excited. And that was what was going on at that high school, Muscatine High School. And I had a great band experience there. I started piano lessons when I was in kindergarten. My mother had been a professional musician, and she wanted to get me started early. But not too long after that, maybe in third grade, I took up French horn lessons, and my first teacher was eventually my high school band director, Charles Cream, who's still living today, by the way. And then my mom started driving me up to the University of Iowa, which is about 45 minutes to an hour away from my hometown, and I studied with the horn professor at Iowa from the time I was in sixth or seventh grade all the way through my undergraduate. And so I had really good quality instruction, and I had people pushing on me all the time, and my mom was a great musician, and she had ears of crystal, so she could hear almost anything that I couldn't hear, and she would definitely let me know. So I grew up never realizing there was anything else out there other than music. The irony is, when I was a high school senior, my mom sat me down one day after school, and she said, well, I think it's time to talk about what you're going to do in college. What do you want to do for a living? And I looked at her with a big question mark on my face and like, what do you mean? She said, well, what is it that you want to do the rest of your life? How are you going to provide for yourself and your family? I said, well, I'm going to be a musician. And she got that look on her face like, why would you want to do something like that? And she said, well, I thought maybe you might like the idea of being a dentist. I started laughing and I said, Mom, you should have told me that a year ago before I got a C in biology. So those days are numbered, that there's no way I'm going to be going into a science major in college. So from that point on, it was just assumed that I was going to be a music major, and lo and behold, that's what I did.
Wow, man. We have a little bit of parallels there because my first private teacher was also my band director, who was Ed Jackson, you know. And after him, I studied with the university horn professor at the time, who was Lynn Beck. So it's, you know, a little bit of parallel there. My parents were musicians, but they didn't read any music. I mean, my dad is a fantastic singer, guitar player, but he doesn't read music. And my mom sings great, and she doesn't read music either.
So. You got great ears, so I'm assuming that it came from them, because a musician that doesn't read has to have really super ears.
I joke with my friends a lot that I wish I had my dad's ears. Anything you play at him, he can play right back at you. It's ridiculous, you know. It's really cool.
Yeah, I honestly wish I had the same ears that I had 40 years ago. But a life in music, I mean, I started playing in band when I was in fourth grade, and orchestra soon thereafter. Mm-hmm. And I played all the way, obviously, through college, and through the next 10 or 11 years while I was teaching high school, I still played. And as much as I love that experience, it took a toll on my ears. Actually, I think probably what's taken a bigger toll on my ears is standing in front of the ensemble every day and hearing cymbal crashes and loud metallic high frequency sounds coming from my left. And so I definitely notice a difference. And I notice it when I have headphones on, that I have to listen harder through my left ear to hear higher overtones and higher pitches and discrepancies.
Yeah, well, now that you're in your 40s, like me, our ears are definitely not the same, man.
Your ears are great. I've heard you play very recently, man, and it's, you're as good as it gets.
Doesn't mean that I can hear still. It just just ask my wife. I'm constantly asking her, huh? What? It drives her nuts.
She's got amazing ears, too. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I believe there's two musicians of your caliber that are married and live in the same household. You're both professional musicians at the highest level. That's pretty crazy.
Well, usually that's a good thing, but during all this COVID stuff, just means that we both don't have any work.
You know? I understand that. I see it on social media all the time. All my friends that play for a living, like Joe, the New York Phil, shutting down its fall season.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Here they are, some of the very finest musicians in the world, that will not have a chance to perform for several months. It's a real loss.
Yeah, it's insanity. I mean, you never think in a million years that something like that would happen. The world of live music just shuts down, you know?
I think this is the one eventuality that none of us really planned on. I think we all thought that if something does happen like that, well, we'll just come up with a cure or a vaccine. And right. It's likely that we may do that, but it's obviously going to take a while. So in the meantime, you're not touring. I'm not rehearsing and going to the university. No traveling. And I know finances, for those of you that are performing constantly, that's pretty major. Fortunately, I live on a university professor's salary, which is not necessarily the greatest salary, but it's still there when I'm not in the office. It's still there until next contract year anyway.
Right. So when you got to college, where did you go to college, first of all?
I went to the University of Iowa. It's at the time, it was one of the very best music schools in the Midwest, if not in the whole eastern part of the country. Jaime Voxman was still the director of the School of Music, the dean of the School of Music, and their teaching faculty were all legendary that had come from major orchestras, and Jaime was a super musician himself. He wrote all those books, those woodwind he ran a very tight but creative ship, so he hired really great people to come in and teach, and so the programs were amazing, and the orchestra was superb, and the band was really good, and your private studio instructors were really fine players. I was very fortunate to have a great college education. And if I were to do it all over again, I would do it exactly the same way that I did, simply because the professors at Iowa were super, and it was a large school, but yet everybody knew everybody. And the performance level of all the ensembles was scary good. So you always got a lot out of it. When I got there, there were 40 horn majors in the studio.
Holy moly.
The fair-haired freshman that came in after doing some good things throughout high school, and you had to fight to play a cycle with the orchestra. You had to really fight for a position. And the same with the symphony band. You literally had to be special if you wanted to play in those groups. So right. Competition is a really great motivator, isn't it?
It sure is, man. Yeah. So at that time, were you into conducting at all, or were you still just like horn?
I had always taken an interest in conducting from the time I was a little kid. My parents' best friends were musicians, and they owned a music store in that little town. And they just lived up the alley from us. They'd get together, and then, like, I was the entertainment for the evening. I would come in and conduct with a drumstick, something that they would put on the stereo. And so it was something that I was really interested in. In high school, my band director involved me a lot as a kind of an assistant conductor, and I was a drum major. And so it was just part of putting my educational packet together, is just conducting. Now, I never thought I was going to be a conductor, however. I wanted to be a professional horn player.
Okay.
In college, during the summer times, I had two jobs. I was a lifeguard at a pool, and I taught at a very famous camp in Indiana, the Smith-Walbridge Camp. I think you know Gary Smith, whose father founded that camp. And I was there several weeks of summer, and part of that was in conducting, and part of it was in drum majoring. And the best part about it was they had master teachers working at that camp. So all of a sudden, as a young man, I had all these wonderful teachers to watch and observe and to determine to glean from them what things that they said and did worked and what things did they say that didn't work in a rehearsal situation.
Right.
So it was really good for me to get that information and that experience, because when I got out of college and went to grad school as a music ed major, and then right away I started teaching high school band, and having that conducting experience and that teaching experience, I was able to hit the ground running and never stopped after that.
So where did you go to grad school then?
I went to Indiana State University, and the reason I had applied to Indiana, I had applied to Bowling Green, I had applied on the East Coast to a couple of schools, and I ended up going to Terre Haute, to Indiana State, because Gary Smith was one of the band directors there. He offered me an assistantship, and so I took that assistantship. At that point in time, it was between Indiana State and Bowling Green, and at Bowling Green was one of my heroes, Mark Kelly. And so I had the choice of two super, so I went for a mentor more than anything. I'd already come from a good band and orchestra experience at Iowa, but I wanted the mentorship of guys that had been successful at teaching high school and then gone on to be successful college educators as well. So that's why I went to Terre Haute.
That's wise, man. Gary is such a great guy. I've gotten to know him later, of course, than you. And he talks nothing but the best stuff about you. Especially, there's one performance, he's brought it up several times, maybe because of the fact that every time we get together, we have, you know, we have a few beverages and maybe we start telling the same stories to each other. But he has brought this one up about you being a soloist with the band. I believe it was a band, or was it the orchestra? And you were playing the Haydn? Was that it?
Probably.
Yeah, and he is just saying that after you did that performance on the horn, all the horn students at the university wanted to study with you.
I was very fortunate. I had really good teaching all the way through high school and through my collegiate experience. And by the time I got to Indiana State, I had changed my mind about being a professional player. I just saw that the trail that led to what I thought I was going to do, which was playing horn in a major symphony. That trail was kind of murky and not and muddy and not very clear.
Right.
And there would have been much more schooling involved, including a DMA or a PhD. And I really enjoyed teaching. And you know, watching Gary Smith teach is like watching the very best. He's a natural born teacher. He relates to you. As soon as he stands in front of you, you are just tuned in to everything that he says and does. And he's very engaging. And he's clever. And so I always thought that it must be a great life in teaching because Gary Smith is doing it and everybody loves him. So, I mean, it was just another motivation for me to go into teaching. So I got my master's degree there. I was there 2 years,
uh-huh.
finished a degree, and I went on to teach high school back in Iowa when I graduated from Indiana State.
Okay, so your first teaching job was at a high school.
Yeah, I was the third band director at Bettendorf High School, which is in the Quad Cities, right on the river, Mississippi River, just up the river from my hometown by about 45 minutes. The director there was a very staunch, long-time conservative high school band director that had built a huge program. So when his third position became open, he was interested in hiring me because I had been the drum major of the Hawkeye Marching Band at Iowa, and that everybody in the state knew that if you were the drum major at Iowa, you were something. So he hired me, and I was there 2 years, and I enjoyed it. It was a great experience. I taught the marching band, I taught the jazz band, and I taught the freshman concert band, which had over 100 people in it. And then the rest of the week, I just taught high brass lessons. It was a really good gig. It didn't pay very much, and I think my first salary was almost $6,000.
Baby.
But, you know, in those days, you know, $6,000 seemed like a lot of money. I'd get to the end of the month and I'd still have money in my checking account.
Especially when you're just getting out of college.
I don't know if I do anymore.
Well, I sure don't. I always have big respect for band directors, especially people who come straight out of college, because college prepares you for a lot. But when you get thrown into the fire and you're all of a sudden in the front of a big ensemble, you have to figure out the jazz band, maybe the choir. You're wearing all these different hats. Then you have to be like a business person and you're trying to figure out trips or doing the grades and you're trying to make a band fund. And it's just like, man, just to be go straight from college into that. I just have so much respect for anybody who's a music educator, you know.
I was fortunate though that because I was the third director at that school, that big decisions were not up to me. Small jobs were, you know, my specialty. I would be given a weekly list of things to do, and they would be, you know, just basic, easy things to accomplish. I wasn't really forced into that situation too much those first 2 years. When I moved to Indiana, though, in my third year, I inherited this wonderful program at Greenwood Community High School, just south of Indianapolis. And the band director directly before me was Herman Knoll. Herman Knoll became a director at Indiana State, and then he became the president of Hal Leonard. And so he gave me the state champion band. The hard part was that the standard was there, and after 2 years, I was expected to hold that standard with those students. Fortunately for me, those students really liked success. And so they put up with me and they taught me what I needed to do to make them successful. They were very patient with me. And I was quite often frustrated. I was too young for a position like that. But I had these wonderful students who were so mature. They just wanted to do well, and they kind of knew the secret sauce, and they helped me learn that secret sauce. And I was there 3 years, and I enjoyed every minute of it, but there was constant competition in that position. And I kept thinking, is this what I really want to do the rest of my life? Do I want to compete all the time? And I'm kind of a person that works to live rather than lives to work. I work hard and I'll work a lot of hours, but there's a point in my life where life becomes more important to me than working an immense amount of hours. So I left after 3 years. I missed those students and I went to Arizona and I took a program that had fallen on hard times, and I was there 6 years, and that thing got going in a hurry. And from there, that's when I came to UNLV.
So you get to UNLV, and what's the program like at that point?
My predecessor had left in controversy. The story was that the students had petitioned him out of his job, and he would have been up for tenure the next year, but he never got that far. But in the meantime, the program lost lots of students. So my first rehearsal with the marching band, this is in August of 1985, had 42 people, I think, on the field for college marching band. And my first wind ensemble rehearsal was 18 students, and it was mostly flutes and trumpets because there were two really good studios on campus. It was the flute studio and the trumpet studio. Wow. So it was just an uphill battle. Fortunately, it was in Las Vegas. So when it came time to play concerts and I didn't have the necessary instrumentation, I would hire people from the Strip to come in and play a dress rehearsal in a concert. And that's how, 3 or 4 years, that's how we got by until we could build up the size of the enrollment of the studio to the point where we could support our own ensemble.
Oh man, that's so cool though. I mean, I know from traveling around that UNLV has a really big name for wind ensemble now. And that's all because of you being in the ensemble for the years that I was. The one thing that really struck me was that you were always commissioning music. And we were always playing like new rep that wasn't mainstream yet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the kind of stuff that we were playing when I was in college in 96 through 2020. In 96 through 2000-ish. It was really pretty new.
Well, by the time 1990, 91 came around and we were mostly students in what was then called the Wind Symphony, I saw a particular kind of student coming to UNLV that was not traditional in terms of music school like where I had gone to school. These were students who were coming to school to be players, and they were coming to school in Las Vegas because they wanted to play professionally and they wanted to do it while they were in school.
Right.
And it was possible. There was a great jazz band at UNLV at the time. Frank Gagliardi was the director, and they had done several European and tours to Japan with the jazz band. And he had an intern program set up on the Strip that after a certain number of semesters in the jazz band, you were assigned to go play in the house band at an orchestra and sit by these really great players. All those students that became interns, they had a spectacular experience. They had a different mentality. They weren't coming to school necessarily to learn to teach or be a band director. They really wanted to be a professional musician. So with that in mind, I started developing my own repertoire for them that I thought would benefit them when they went out into the professional world. Because, for example, you know that you sometimes are going to have to play on the jazz side of your horn. Sometimes it's going to be strictly classical. Sometimes it's going to be commercial. Yep. And it's not always the same. And you can choose your repertoire because, you know, you're in the legendary Boston Brass. So you guys can choose your repertoire. But most of these students will sign a contract to play and they'll be told, you get one rehearsal and then the light goes on. So that was why I started doing that in the early 90s then, and it just got more so as the years went on.
Well, that's really cool. I never knew that that was why. I mean, it makes total sense, though. It makes total sense. And I had no idea that UNLV had a kind of mentorship program where you can go and play on the Strip. That's so cool, man.
I think of specific students from the very old days. There was a student by the name of Scott Duncan, who I believe is an engineer now. But he was playing in the jazz band, and he was playing saxophone in the jazz band. But in Wind Symphony, he played oboe. He was a really good oboist and had a great sound on oboe. So we were getting a lot of students that were doublers.
That's not your normal double, though.
I know. I was so fortunate to have him because he was a superb musician. So fortunately, you have these wonderful players that maybe came to school for jazz. Maybe they came to school to play classical. But you had pretty good principal players in almost every section. And so that's really good for the rest of the students in the section to see what their first year player plays like. Yeah. And that's what you aim for. Yeah. And so that's kind of how the wind orchestra developed. And hopefully what we're doing now is just an extension of that.
You know, the wind orchestra, it's become really prolific with the recordings that you've put out. I mean, you've got, how many recordings have you guys put out now?
Number 21 just got released a month or two ago.
21.
85 and 21 since then.
It was in 95, you said?
Yeah.
Was that the Ghost Train album?
Yeah, that was the red CD that had the premiere performance of the first movement of Ghost Train, which at the time was the only Ghost Train that was out there, until Eric figured out that, wait a minute, I can write two more movements and call it a triptych and make a whole lot more money. And then the next CD was Ghost Train, and it had all three movements. But that was kind of a break. Those were breakout CDs, and that's kind of laid the groove for where it all went next.
Yeah, well, the band always sounds amazing. When I was in the group, I felt that it sounded really great. I mean, I tell this to people all the time, that for me, that was the part that I looked forward to the year the most. And those sessions were hard. I mean, we were playing hours and hours a day under intense scrutiny, and you have such a great rapport with your students. But when the time comes and the red light is on, you expect to hear a certain quality, you know, and if you're not getting that, you'll let people know. And that to me was something that I really loved, because I want that magnifying glass on me. If you're going to be a performance major, you have to have that. What I'm getting at is that your incredible recording repertoire has improved the lives of so many students. And not only that, it's risen UNLV to a status where it probably would not be if those recordings weren't out there. So
after the first CD came out in 95, I realized the validity and the necessity of having recordings, because we didn't have money to tour. We couldn't even take a short tour to Arizona or to California, because there was just not enough resource to be able to do it. But we could afford to put recordings out. They weren't, at the time, they weren't very expensive. And the first 10 or so recordings were all made basically from live concerts and dress rehearsals. We'd take the concert recording, and then if there was an issue or there was a gaffe or something, we'd take something out of a dress rehearsal and edit it in. There weren't very many edits, but there was an energy about those old recordings on Mark Records, because it was a concert that became the standard for those CDs after we changed that whole thing. And we started recording for Clavier back in 02 or 03. And they were studio style recordings. You'd have to do multiple takes. But yet when you got done with the recording and then you edited it all together, that same energy was still there. It was part of the tradition of the ensemble by that time. What's also changed for the students that have been going through the program for the last 7, 8, 10 years, where they will flat out tell you it's the best week of the year. And they go into it with all sorts of trepidation. They go into it, you know, concerned, especially if they have big exposures and solos. But it gives them an opportunity to bring it on and bring the heat. And I mean, just in itself, that's just another notch of elevation for them on their instrument and more confidence for them. And then they walk out into a live performance and it's just that much better. So it's all part of the process. There were people, Chris, through the years that didn't want the wind orchestra to record, or didn't want the wind orchestra to record every year. Don't we have enough? Well, No, the group is better this year than ever before, and these students deserve the same opportunity that the students had 5 years ago, maybe even more so.
Well, another reason why I think your students are so committed is because of the fact that you bring in so many great guest artists to come and play. I mean, over the years, you've had such amazing artists, and not just classical artists, but I mean, just mainstream artists, jazz artists. And they come in, they solo with the Wind Orchestra, they record with the Wind Orchestra. How did you start bringing in and commissioning music for these artists and Wind Orchestra?
That's a great question. And as the story goes, Tony Labonte, who's my colleague and, you know, best professional friend in life, and I were back in the 80s huge, well, back before the 80s, actually, huge Chick Corea fans. Mm-hmm. I've always been a Chick Corea admirer, and every band that he's ever formed. And he had formed a group back in the 80s called the Electric Band. And I heard this saxophone player on the Electric Band's second CD, Light Years, which they won a Grammy for. And I actually happened to be in Japan when I heard him for the very first time. We took a group from UNLV to Japan for 6 months as a show band. We performed in amusement parks. And so one of the students had bought this new CD, and I said, man, who is that saxophone player? And he says, his name is Eric Marienthal. And right away, I kind of gravitated to that because my mother's maiden name was Rosenthal. So I figured that we probably came from roughly the same origin. And
both of the Thals.
Yeah, the Thals, right. So Tony and I would constantly go see the Electric Band when they would come through town, which at the time, in those years, they came through quite often. So at the end of one concert, Tony and I were sitting in the front row worshiping these guys. And here comes Eric at the end of the concert to get his equipment off the stage. And we introduce ourselves, and we take him to dinner not too long after that. And I ask him if he would play a solo with the Wind Symphony at CBDNA, College Band Directors National Association, at the Double Regional in Reno, which was at the Western Regional and the Northwest Regional. It's huge. Uh-huh. And we had been invited. The first time that we had been invited to do anything, it's the first time I ever took the band anywhere. Literally, they never went across the street before that. It's true. And so he said he would enjoy doing that. Could I mail him the music? So I sent him the music. It was from a Dana Wilson piece entitled Time Cries Hoping Otherwise. It wasn't jazz. It was classical, but it was a little edgy classical. It was almost like crossover style classical. And so here we are a week before the premiere in Reno. And I get a phone call, and it's Eric, and he's got a very hoarse voice. He just got back from tour in Asia. And he said, I just looked at this music, and I realized that this is not a jazz band.
This is not a jazz band.
And I said, no, it was for the Wind Symphony. We still laugh about this. So he says, it's got so many notes. and there are three movements, and he said, how about if we just play the first movement or even the first two movements? And I said, I wish it was that simple, Eric, but the program is already printed. We have to play the entire piece. It was a three movement concerto for saxophone and wind ensemble.
And he had just looked at it.
He was looking for a way out. So he told me, okay, he says, I'm just going to cancel all my gigs between now and the time I see you guys in Reno. And I'm going to go practice and shit every day until I get this. He says, don't worry, I'll be there and I'll make it work. So he comes, we meet him at Reno. We're at McQueen High School, where Clay Redfield, my good friend, was the band director, let us use his rehearsal room. And he came into the room and we read it down with the then Wind Symphony. Uh-huh. And he was phenomenal. It was like, this is how this piece should sound. And we get done with all three movements. So just a reading. We just had a reading with him. And the whole room just was in electric quiet. We were just buzzing. And I looked over to my left at Eric, and he looked at me with these sheepish eyes. He says, was it okay? laughing, and everybody just starts cheering and standing up and applauding, and it was so perfect. And in the meantime, he's taking the sheet music and he's turned it upside down. He says, "Oh, now I've got to figure it out." So this was, that was the beginning of using guest artists, and it all came from my desire to work with Chick Corea. It went on from there, and there's just been a whole host of them, not only jazz guys. I'm not a jazzer, I'm a horn player. Right. But I listened to jazz from the time I was a little kid, because my mom was a jazz aficionado. And I figured out, wait a minute, I'm at UNLV, I've got all these wonderful jazz musicians here. Why would I not want to do something like that and also help prepare them for their future? And so it all just kind of came together, and that's how it moved from there.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the best things about your program. You're just broadening the spectrum of what wind orchestra is capable of doing music-wise. And not only that, but the students love that music. It's not, I mean, there's only so many times you can play the same band music that's been around for a long time. But I mean, it's just different styles. If you're a performance major and say you want to get into an orchestra, but you've never had any experience in any other style of music, you're really doing yourself a disservice.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I think it's incredibly important. And don't get me wrong, I love Schoenberg Variations, Opus 43A. Yep. I love the Hindemith Symphony. I love all those pieces. I love a lot of the pieces that are being written now by Stephen Bryant and et cetera, et cetera. And I'll play some of those, and I have played some of those. In fact, I've commissioned some of those pieces. But I see my students as my primary focus. I want them to get experience on standards. So we program standards in other situations, but we play what we play because it's a learning curve and it's something they have to go through. They're going to step into the professional world.
It's so great, man. It's top-notch education for people who are going to be educators and performers.
And it doesn't mean it doesn't have to be classical. I mean, one of the commissions that we did this past year for the President's Concert in November, I commissioned my colleague Zane Douglas to write a transcription of the Handsome Romantic Symphony, three movements.
Oh, man, that's so cool.
22 minutes. And it's a beautiful transcription. And it had never been transcribed. And there were only just three or four recordings of it out there for orchestra. And in my opinion, none of them are really great. They're good, but they're not great. And so I just thought it fits well for the wind orchestra. So he transcribed it, and that was also going to be recorded this spring. So we'll have to bring that back somehow next year. But there are so many opportunities to commission people to do things, whether it's new music or to a transcription of something that has already been written.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Zane is such a great musician. I remember playing in the ensemble with him. He's a great trombone player, first of all. I mean, the guy always sounded awesome. But his musicianship, especially when he transcribes and stuff like that, he's very thoughtful.
He tries to keep it pure. First of all, we don't change keys when we transcribe from an original. That makes it, you know, super difficult for a lot of people. But the composer intended it for it to sound like that, otherwise he wouldn't have written in that key. And, you know, with every key comes a new sense of brightness or darkness.
That's something that a lot of people don't think about. They think about, oh, this is going to be much easier for the winds, or this will be easier for the brass. But they don't think about the fact that the composer put thought into what key something is. And the key really does make a difference. It's just, it's not the same anymore.
Yeah, or put it into a band-friendly key, and all of a sudden it loses all its color and excitement. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it has to, but it happens most times. So Zane doesn't do that. He keeps it pure, and he has an orchestrational style where it really captures the essence of the orchestral sound, even though we're without most of the strings. Now I run a cello or two if I can, and I run two or three basses, double basses if I can.
Oh, wow.
With Zane's writing, I mean, he's written everything from the Handsome we just spoke of. He wrote Ventanas from the Ventana CD that we released several years ago by Revueltas, or the saxophone concerto that was written for David Sanborn and the London Phil several years ago that he transcribed for wind orchestra and saxophone, and Eric came and recorded it with us. So he's extraordinarily talented. And again, we're giving these students an extra advantage by putting these pieces together for them, because this is something that in a traditional setting, you wouldn't necessarily find happening.
Right. Well, hey man, I always want to ask you this. If you weren't a musician, what would you be doing?
Well, I wouldn't be a dentist. So
I know that.
I would probably, I've told my wife this many times, I would probably be a winemaker. Or if I learned the skills of distilling and aging, barrel aging things, I would have done something like that. I love to cook, but I'm certainly not like an Emeril Lagasse. But a winemaking or distilling, those use, you know, your taste palate, and it's very much like your hearing palate, hearing colors and how to combine colors. And it's much the same when you're developing something with taste. And so that's always been something of interest to me. But I kind of gave up on the idea of it 10 years ago because I thought, if I'm making wines now, I'm going to be 65 before they're drinkable. Or if I'm going to start distilling spirits now, it's going to take 12 years before this bourbon turns into something that tastes like bourbon. So
I never even thought about that. If you're like in your 50s and you decide you want to make bourbon or something, it's like if it's aged 12 years, then...
Yeah, hope you're still around when it's time to taste it.
And that's the cheap stuff. You won't even be around anymore for the expensive stuff.
You know, my dad was a mechanic. When he came out of World War II, he was a medic in World War II, but when he got home, he grew up in a little town in Kentucky, up in the Appalachian Mountains, and on a farm, and his family couldn't afford to send him to medical school. And even with a VA loan, he couldn't afford going to medical school, so he went to a technical trade school, and he became a car mechanic, and he opened up a Standard Oil gas station and a large service area, tires, brakes, et cetera, in my little hometown. And he was like the center for everything related to cars in that little town.
Interesting.
And he didn't want me ever to learn how to be a mechanic because I was headed toward a life in music. And so he wouldn't teach me anything. I mean, to this day, if my wife Tracy sees me grab a hammer or some pliers out of a tool chest, she'll take them away from me because she knows there's going to be a lot of damage done.
I know you don't own a hammer or pliers, man.
I just stay away from them because I'm incapable. Yeah, I love cars, as you know.
Oh, I know. I was going to ask you. So obviously your love of cars came from your father being a mechanic and him being around cars.
He had great cars. They were quasi-family cars that he would really modify and make look great. And
is there a car that you remember your dad having that you really dug?
Well, first of all, anything that my dad did, I mean, I've never had a hero in my life like him. And so everything that he did, it was like, well, that must be the way that God intended it because my dad's doing it that way. So, he was my hero forever. I always wondered why he wouldn't like show me how to change the oil or, you know, change a fan belt or even take the dipstick out of the engine. And he wouldn't want me to do any or change a tire. He didn't want me to do that. But he would always come to my concerts. As long as he was alive, he would come to concerts. And when I was a high school band director and we were off at a marching contest, he would come and I would go see him before the awards were released. And he would say, Tom, today you won. You're number one. How do you know that? He says, you can just hear the difference. So, you know, he probably had good ears, but he didn't want me to do what he was going to do. He was really the greatest man I ever knew, and he was just a gentle giant. He never lost his temper, never had to, because I never wanted to disappoint him.
Yeah.
And so I was just so fortunate to grow up with a mentor and a role model like that in my house.
Wow, man. Well, that's really touching to hear, because as a father, that's something that I hope someday my son would say about me, you know? So
I think he will.
I don't know if he can ever say the never lost his temper thing. So what was your first car then? Because I remember the first car that I remember you having. When I met you, you had that RX-7.
Yeah, that twin turbo RX-7.
It was red, right? I love that car.
It was super duper. The first car I ever owned was a 62 Ford Fairlane. I owned it in high school. Well, my parents bought it for me, because driving me to the University of Iowa every week for lessons, yeah, and taking me up to the Quad Cities every Saturday for orchestra rehearsal in the Quad City Symphony or the Youth Symphony, it just got old for them. So as soon as I could get a license, my mom marched me down to the driver's license office, and I had my license, and I drove myself.
That's how I am with my daughter, man. She's 14. She's got all these lessons, like cheerleading and gymnastics and all this stuff. And I'm like, hey, you know what? As soon as you're 16, you are getting a car and you are driving yourself around.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when I was in college, I drove a 64 Ford Fairlane because it was something that we could afford. And then my dad bought me, when I graduated from college, the super duper souped up model Javelin. And I kept that while I was in grad school for 2 years. And then my first year teaching, I traded that in on an MG MGB right off the showroom. It was like 1974 or 5, brand new. And then I had the fever bad at that point in time. I made so many bad car deals. My car got dusty and it was time to get something that wasn't dusty anymore. And so I would go get a new car. I bought my first Porsche in, oh man, it was probably 1975. I had that MGB for a year. I traded it in on a used 911, probably a 2 or 3 year old 911 that had 60,000 miles on it. And that's when I moved to Indiana, and it was a cold winter, and that car just ate me out of house and home. It was so expensive to keep it running. I remember I had picked it up one day. There was a problem with the timing chain. I couldn't afford to take it to the dealership, to take it to a separate independent garage. As I'm pulling onto Highway 31 in Greenwood, Indiana, my right front tire comes off the car and is rolling off onto the sidewalk into a service station. And luckily, this car had the engine in the rear, so it didn't ride on that front wheel.
The whole tire came off.
Yeah, the front right tire came off. So I had that. Eventually, it was every 2 weeks, it was something else. So I had to trade it in. And then I've just had so many cars since then. But the last 20 years or so, it's just been nothing but Porsche. And I'm always poor, but I'm always happy with my car.
Well, since I've known you, I remember the RX-7. Then I remember you got the Boxster. Mm. The Boxster was really cool.
I remember going to Germany, well, going to Europe in 95, Tracy and I took the Nevada Ambassadors Band on tour in Europe for a concert, and our main bus driver was totally into cars, and so while we were driving all over Europe, he would like point at cars and tell me what they were, and one day we see a Boxster, and I had only heard rumors that there was going to be a new Porsche, and that it was going to be maybe in my pay grade. So we were actually staying overnight in Austria, in Seefeld, Austria, which is a beautiful ski town. But it was in the middle of summer, so there was no skiing. But he came and knocked on my hotel door, and he says, hey, come with me. So he took me to a parking lot where there was a brand new Boxster. And I thought, one day it will be mine. Oh, yes, it will be mine. And so my wife, Tracy, knows that once the car bug bites me, you can't argue with it. You just get out of his way and let him do it. So I drove to Scottsdale, Arizona, and bought a brand new Boxster. And that was a beautiful car.
It was.
I bought a second Boxster S, because I wanted something faster. And boy, it was fast. And then it came time to go, well, I had a 911 when I was just out of grad school. So can I afford a 911? Well, no, but I'm going to get one anyway.
That's what life's all about. That's what you were talking about.
Yeah, somebody had bought it and turned it back in with 3,000 miles on it. And immediately it fell into my price range. So I bought it, I kept it until I paid it off. I bought another 911, had a beautiful 991 that I just traded in January for a 992.
Well, that 991 was, I mean, that was a special edition car.
Yeah, it was platinum edition.
You were supposed to sell it to me. Then you traded in.
Well, I offered it to you.
I wouldn't have been able to get it anyway. But dude, well, first of all, let me say that your wife, Tracy, not only is she a great musician and a great band director, but she is a saint, man.
Somehow she has been able to deal with me for 25 years.
That's the saint part.
Well, I love her more than life itself, and I'm sure she feels the same way about me. And she looks the other way so much when it comes time to buy cars or something expensive that, yeah, my mother taught me to have a champagne taste, but on a beer budget. So
I like that.
I definitely like the nicer things, and I'll figure out a way. So Tracy, she's an enabler. That's what one of the many things I love about her. She empowers me, and she enables me to do the things that I think are important.
Well, so, and not only that, but she gets hers also. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got to tell you, I like her. Well, I haven't been in your new car yet, which is like freaking killer. I know, because I've seen pictures. But her SUV, I would prefer that over maybe your last 911.
Yeah, her interior.
Now, what is it called?
It's a Macan.
Macan, that's it. Macan, yeah.
When she picked it out, she could have picked out more expensive models. Mm-hmm. It had twin turbos. But she got in this car and she saw this incredible interior that was like black and red, and the detail, the stitching, the leather, everything was so impressive that, I mean, she drove the car for a mile and she looked over at me and she said, yeah, this is going to be it. Can we afford this? And I said, why would you ask that question? You know, I never asked that question of you when I buy a car. So, yeah, she bought it, and she deserves it. You know, you drive to work every day, and you drive home, and you want to look forward to those drives, because when you get where you're going, you want to be happy.
Well, I'm totally with you on that. There are things that you need to spend money on. One thing is a car, because, listen, you're in your car all the time. And it's like you can either be in a car where the AC doesn't work and all this stuff, and it's like you're torturing yourself, but you have to drive it. It's not like it's like something that, oh, I would love to go for a drive to. No, you got to go places. So might as well make it something that you like. Another thing, buy a bed that you love.
That's
comfortable. You spend half your life in the bed. Buy a nice bed.
Absolutely. The truth. And you have to surround yourself with things that will enhance your spirit. I happen to like art. I love paintings. I love statues and sculpture, and our walls are full of things that we love. And I walk through the house and I get a lot of joy from those. And it helps me to relax when I'm having issues in my life and I'm bugged about something. Yeah. Those pieces, you know, there's just an aesthetic appreciation of those pieces that stay with me.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's something I wanted to ask you about. Once again, going way back in our conversation to your recordings, the artwork on the CDs is really special, like especially in the past decade or so. I know that a lot of it is from the same artist, and and it's just so unique and really cool looking and hip. And it's something that I noticed right away. I noticed when you started using this artist, and I was like, wow, what is this? What is this CD art? I didn't even realize it was real paintings that you were doing it from. So who is that person? How did you get into that?
Well, the very first CD had a Japanese kanji syllable on it that said music. And so we carried that through to the next CD. And then I found a local artist who did like cartoon style drawing. And because a lot of the title tracks of those CDs were very fun and engaging titles, we would come up with ideas that matched those titles.
I remember that, like Godzilla Eats Las Vegas. And like
that was an interesting one. I don't know how much time you have, but originally that CD cover I took to this particular artist in town, and I wanted a picture of Godzilla taking a bite out of the Las Vegas sign. And so he did it for me. And then I emailed Eric Whitaker, who wrote the tune, the title track, Godzilla Eats Las Vegas. And I asked him, are we cool with this? Have we got the rights for this image and this title? He said, yeah, we're all good to go. But later I found out that we weren't good to go. And I had to have the artist redo the cover art that made it look like a giant lizard taking a bite out of the Las Vegas sign. And we respelled Godzilla.
Like G-A-W.
Yeah, you're right.
S with a dollar sign.
And I
wondered why it was like that. So it was
probably wasn't legal, but you know, in those days, we did it because that's all we could afford to do. And so then when we jumped over to Clavier, we also kind of jumped into the next level of artwork for the cover. So then I used Clifford Bailey, who's an artist in LA, and I've seen his art in so many galleries. And we were in a gallery in Malibu, California one summer. Tracy said, Tom, come check out this painting. And it was this cool picture of these hipster people from the 50s or the early 60s with all these vibrant colors. And I said, that is perfect. We were trying to come up with artwork for The Four Flew Over the Hornet's Nest.
That's a Tanoi piece, right?
That's a Nathan Tanoi piece, yeah.
And so, you remember, I don't mean to get off track here, but you remember who the person was to recommend Nathan writing for the group.
Yeah, it was you.
That's right.
It was you. And so that's when he wrote Three Steps Forward. That's an amazing tune. I thought the recording turned out really well. First recording with Bruce Leake and Clavier. And then, so then came Four Flew. And that's when I said, well, I'm going to email Clifford Bailey and see if he's interested. Well, he was like more than interested. And he said, send me pictures. Let me know when the concert is. I want to check it out. So, we come over from LA and check out rehearsals, check out the concert. And then he came up with that painting. So we used him for several of the more recent CDs. Uh-huh. And then my friend Carlo Marchiori, who's an artist who was born in Venice, and we used him for two or three pieces on the Clavier CDs. And the last CD, the newest CD, we just was released, which is entitled Quaternity. This is the piece that we did with Joel. Ah, it's the one. That artwork is by a really great old friend of mine, John Rashinho, who was my percussion instructor when I taught high school in Tucson. Now he's the orchestra conductor at Cal State Northridge. He's an incredible artist.
Okay, so here's an idea. I mean, I don't know if you have like a cover for your next album yet. You probably do. But the one after that, you know the horn player Jerry Peel, right?
Yeah.
He's a legendary New York horn player. He played the opening and the Broadway recording of Les Mis. He was on Frank Sinatra, Barbara Streisand, Chuck Mangione's album, The Lullaby, ending on that high F, like doing the lip trill and stuff. So I just interviewed him not too long ago, and he's an artist now. He's retired from the horn, and he only does art, and his art is really, really hip. So
I'll have to contact him. That sounds like fun.
It's a match made in heaven. I think I just did a Hello Dolly here.
The new CD, the artwork's already been commissioned from Clifford, Espresso Express. We'll see how that turns out. I'm sure it'll be hip and cool. But after that, we're going to need the next CD.
I'll tell you what, man, your student, and he's the principal trumpet player, right? Who wrote that Espresso Express.
Yes, he is.
He's really on fire right now. And that's what I love to see come out of this university is people who are just super talented, super fire in the belly driven, and they're doing great things.
Well, he is very similar to your trajectory coming out of the Las Vegas Academy, which is an arts magnet high school.
Yeah, we went to the same high school.
Yeah, absolutely. He came to UNLV. He played a lot of jazz in high school, so he played jazz, and he played in the wind orchestra. He's good on both sides of the horn. And he started, this is crazy, but several years ago, he would come up at the end of rehearsals, and he said, Professor, would you be interested if I wrote some treasury of scales for the ensemble? Because every day we start off our rehearsal with at least one of those just to get everybody's ears into the group and hone the sound. And I said, yes. And so the next day he brought back a fully orchestrated 9-bar treasury of scales. And it was written in the style of Jerry Goldsmith. Then he did it again with John Williams. And then he did again with Eric Korngold. And he did several of them. And I thought, man, you should put together a book and do more of these because they're valuable and they're really, really good. And all he was doing was learning how to orchestrate for wind orchestra.
Right.
He was using it as his fodder to build himself into something where he could write a piece for wind orchestra. So a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I finally said to him toward his senior year, I said, why don't you write a piece for the wind orchestra? By this time, he'd already won several jazz downbeat awards for composition. He'd already been given Monterey awards at the Monterey Jazz Festival for his writing and his playing, but he hadn't written anything on the other side of the page.
Uh-huh.
So he wrote a piece and the title was Bite the Bullet. Bite the Bullet is the name of a painting that my friend, hang on while I show you Bite the Bullet. There it is up there. It's a painting of two Punchinella clowns, baker's clowns, having a duel, but it's just in fun. So I said, take a look at this painting and write a piece.
Interesting.
So he wrote a piece and we recorded it. It's on the Quaternity CD. And then he just found out a couple of days ago that he won the American prize for it. He's just a success story and everything just gets bigger and better.
Well, I know that he just, he was writing something for Joe Alessi also. We just interviewed Joe Alessi on our Boston Brass hang over Zoom, and Joe brought him up and said that he had taken a chance on him and he had him write him a piece, and he is really loving it.
Ironically, when Joe was in town a little bit over a year ago to premiere Quaternity, the piece that Bruce Broughton had written for him, mm-hmm. on that same concert, we opened the concert up with Bite the Bullet. And Joe, that's where Joe heard it. And right. So it was Joe that approached Jorge and said, would you be interested in writing a piece for me? You know, and Jorge had never even thought about going down that avenue.
Right.
So, of course, the first words out of Jorge's mouth, I'd be honored to do so, maestro. And so
I ain't gonna say no to that.
Yeah, then the collaboration starts, and I know that Chris Martin, the principal trumpet of the New York Phil, is already contacted Jorge, and they've discussed this the idea of writing a trumpet piece, and he wrote another piece for me that we just did this year, and wrote a piece for the Las Vegas Academy, which is stunning. He's just got it, you know. He's got kind of what you have. He's just got that special magical talent and the spirit to drive it forward. And here's another reason that he reminds me of you. He's humble and he's balanced, and he approaches everything as it's a learning experience and that it's a blessing for him. And that's something that I always worshiped about you. You were the same way, and you were such a great advocate when you were an undergrad at UNLV for musicianship and musicality. You set the groove for that brass section And that brass section has never looked back ever since. And they're still trying to achieve those same goals that you helped establish for them. And I mentioned that recently in an interview I did with Fanfare Magazine about how you changed the trajectory of that wind orchestra because of the expectation and the standards of musicianship and musicality during the course of rehearsals, because rehearsals are concerts and concerts are recordings and it's all the same.
Well, that's really nice, man. I mean, I got to tell you, just like you earlier in this interview, talking about how you wouldn't do anything different, go to a different school, I wouldn't have done anything different also. The bottom line is you get out of it what you put into it. And yeah, there are great people to learn from at every place that you're going to go. It doesn't matter if it's a small university. It doesn't matter if it's Juilliard. Doesn't matter if you're getting a full scholarship or if it's a $50,000 a year institution. The bottom line is when you're a musician, you're making music. It's coming from here and it's coming from the wealth of knowledge of people that you've learned from. And for me, I don't think I could be where I am if it wasn't for people like you and everybody else that I had an intimate musical relationship with as a younger player. I don't think you can put a dollar sign on that. I don't know. I just really appreciate that, man. I value our relationship. And I think that the things that you've done are special and the things that you've done are revolutionary. And I'm honored to call you my friend, man.
I'm fortunate in that when you came to UNLV, it probably saved me a stint in jail because I was going to have to go kidnap you wherever you were going to go if you didn't go to UNLV, because I knew that we were going to build something really special together. And of course, I think that happened. And as I said earlier, my happiness is based on the success of my students. So the fact that I watch you and listen to you, I can't be happier. Like, what else is there? This is what a teacher or a conductor, musician lives for, is for the success of the people that they work with and teach. How could I be any more fortunate than that, to have had world famous musicians such as you come through and then come back and solo with the group? And by the way, man, that recording that you did, both on Tony Labonte's piece, Prophecy, as I said in that review on Fanfare, or that article on Fanfare, I said, Tony has just pushed the envelope for every horn player, because you have to have otherworldly skills like Chris does to be able to play that stuff. And as a result, and you played it, and you played it really, really, really well. And so it's a beautiful performance. And then on top of that, the recording that we did together all those years ago of Knee High by the Fourth, I had my friend Wendell Upons write a piece for the ensemble, and it was dedicated to my high school band director. And the story was, it was about a young high school student who was a horn player growing up in the cornfields of Iowa. And there was a lovely horn solo in it, which you played. And so when this CD started formulating itself in my mind, I asked Wendell if he would write three other movements to go with Knee High by the Fourth to make it a full four movement suite, which he did do. Your performance on that was stunning. That is extraordinarily difficult writing, and you, if you listen to it, you make it look easy, and it's so beautiful. And then I think, that's my student that just did that. That's my former student. That's, how outrageous is that? So, you know, there were two soloists on this last disc, you and Joe Alessi, and as Fanfare said in their review, the soloists are unbelievable.
Well, thanks so much, man. I mean, it was an honor to play with the group, and it was an honor to be on the same album as Joe Alessi, because that guy is a legend. Ever since I've been in high school, he's been a legend. He still is. He's he's the epitome of the brass playing, like, just God. You know, I mean, he's a machine, but he's a musical machine.
Yeah, he's natural, isn't it? It's just so, he puts the horn to his face and it's just so natural. And rehearsing with him as we were getting ready to premiere Quaternity, he was just a quiet and very musical leader in front of the ensemble. There was no need for stress, and he loved the ensemble, and the whole experience of working with him was, you know, I had waited my, and I'd worked with Eric and many others, but to work with Joe, I mean, the guy is probably the best trombone player to have ever lived.
Oh, yeah. The wealth of recordings that he's put out, it's ridiculous, man. So
you told some pretty mean stories on that Boston Brass Zoom. I played it back and I was dying laughing.
Well, you know, I could talk to you literally all day long just because we're brothers. But the one thing that I know everybody respects you for, on par with your musicality, is the fact that you know how to treat people. You know how to treat guest artists. You know how to be a friend, and you know how to be a great colleague. Everybody knows that when Tom Leslie has somebody come and play with him, or if you're going to go hang out with Tom Leslie at Midwest or whatever, you're going to have an amazing time. That is a networking skill. When we were talking to Joe, one of the first things Joe said was, Tom knows how to have a great time. And then the Boston Brass guys were like, Tom is basically the king of Las Vegas. It's like the guy just knows what to do to have a great time. So my question to you, I guess this is a long way about going about it, but is, when did you realize that you wanted to not just be kind of like a stiff, okay, I'm going to have you as a guest and I'm going to put you in this hotel room and I will see you at rehearsal. But no, when Tom has you over, it's, I'm going to wine and dine you. We're going to have a great time. We're going to conversationalize. We're going to this and that. It's like, when did you decide that? Or is that just something you always had?
Well, first of all, we talked about my father. And my father was a people person. Everybody in my little hometown came to get their gasoline, came to do all of their car-related stuff to my father's station. And he was very successful, because he was a people person, and he was very sincere, and he never said a mean thing to anybody ever, and never was sarcastic to anybody unless he was telling a joke or something.
Sure.
He was just, you know, as down home as it gets. And I watched, as I grew up, I watched him, and I compared him to other older men and other people's fathers. And I realized, he's different. There's something about him. So I wanted to be like him.
Yeah.
And then I was fortunate coming through school with Gary Smith and teaching in the situations that I did to have good mentors. But when I finally did meet Dr. Julian, J. Julian from Tennessee, and Colonel Bourgeois, who was the conductor, of course, of the President's Own for all those years, they were super mentors on how to be a professional. If you want to work with the best, then you have to be the best with them. And that means more than just the best on the podium. That means you wanted to develop a working relationship with them. And so I really put it together from the things that they did and said. So I was just lucky to have great mentors. So if I'm doing anything for my students that are going to go out and do something similar, it's important that when you invite someone in to work with your students, you make them feel special, because they're going to give you everything that they have. You know, all the guards are going to come down, and they're going to deliver all the qualities that make them a great player and a great musician and a great person. And so experiences like Joe was perfect to work with him. I think he could be my brother. So that's, you know, that's just what's important. And I would advise any young professional Yes, go ahead and commission pieces if you can afford it. Yes, bring in guest artists, because every time you do either one of those things, the beneficiaries, the real beneficiaries, are your students. They carry that forward. And that's what helps make a difference for them in their future life. Everything that I do it because I believe it's right, and I'm trying to do the right thing for my students.
Wow, man. I mean, I can't think of a better note to end on than that. I mean, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate hanging out with you. And I can't wait till the next time I see you in person, which who knows when that is. I might be in Vegas sometime soon. I don't know if this is podcast material, but I picked up my dad like a couple weeks ago to come and hang out with us for a week because we had been distancing and everything. So we knew we were good. And I knew my dad needed just a little bit of a vacation. So I drove to Vegas, picked up my dad, drove him back to our place. He stayed with us for a week. I drove him back and then drove back because I don't want him flying, which is about 6-hour drive instead of a 1-hour flight. And I think I might be doing the same thing with my mom sometime soon. And when I do that, I'm going to have to come to your guys' place.
Yeah, you're going to have to come over because, you know, I've got all these bottles of wine in here that we need.
How many bottles do you have now?
Oh, I don't know. It's not as many as I used to have. I suppose there's probably 200 bottles in this cabinet behind me, and there's another 40 or 50 in the other cabinet that's mostly for white wines.
Well, how about the boxes next to you?
Well, there's some in there, too.
If you're not counting them, I'll just take them home.
Oh, man. Well, you know, I love your family, and your mom and dad are the greatest. I've known them forever.
Oh, they're the best.
I get to say I admire you. I tell my students that these days all the time, but I think that I learned how to admire your student when you were in the group because you were admirable and you captured my imagination, and I realized that you and I had a very similar heart, and we'll lay it all on the line if we have to. And so I'm just so happy to be, thank you for asking me to be a part of your program.
Oh man, this was a pleasure. I mean, I started this thing basically because I'm stuck at home and I want to have a good time with my friends still. But I knew that when I talked to you, it would be special because we have a different kind of relationship. So thank you so much, man.
Thank you, Chris.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers to you. This is my second martini.
Yeah, look at what you made me do, man.
You were pretty sneaky about that, too.
All right. I'll catch you later, Tom.
Okay. God bless you.
Thank you so much, man. Bye.